3 plus 2 makes 5, plus 5 makes 10, plus 10 makes 20. 20 sous. Ridiculous. In addition, on the 24th, a small, suggestive enema preparatory and softening to massage, moisten and refresh the posterior of the patient. What I find most pleasing about my pharmacist's invoices is the decorum of Monsieur Florence Bills, a most gracious apothecary. Let me see. Bowel evacuation, 30 sous. Monsieur Florent, it's not enough to write eloquently. One must also be reasonable and not skin the sick alive with the price. 30 sous for an enema.
Well, it's making us laugh right now, and I suspect that the imaginary invalid will continue to make people laugh for a long time. That was Charlie Bauer, who plays the main character Argon in The Imaginary Invalid, a play by Jean-Baptiste Poquelin, better known as Molière, who was one of the most influential playwrights in all of Western drama, celebrated in particular for his satires of 17th-century French society, which include his last play, The Imaginary Invalid. More than 300 years later, what makes it work so well? I'm Norman Gilliland.
And I'm Emily Auerbach. This is University of the Year.
How was Molière able to make a living after lampooning powerful members of the upper classes? And why did his funeral have to take place at night? What happened during his fatal last performance of that last play, and what effect, if any, did he have on playwrights that came after him? Our guests are putting on a University Theater production of Molière's Imaginary Invalid. They are the director, Patricia Boyette, the dramaturg, Barbara Clayton, and cast member Charlie Bauer.
Welcome to University of the Year.
Thank you.
Thank you.
I like the way you've got it billed as University Theater's response to the healthcare debate.
Right.
You know, a way to take a 17th century farce and make it sort of relevant today. Let's start with you, Patricia, as the director. What excites you about the production of The Imaginary Invalid, about the play itself?
About the play itself? Well, the comedy. I mean, Molière is a genius. I'm surprised that we don't do him more in this country. I mean, he's done in Europe. It's like Shakespeare. It's like we would do Shakespeare here. Molière in Europe is done that frequently. And it still holds up. A lot of plays 300 years after the time it was written don't have the kind of life that Molière continues to have for us. And just The Imaginary Invalid is about a hypochondriac. We still have hypochondriacs. We still have medicines and treatments that are thought of as being fashionable, whatever the medicine of the day or the treatment of the day is, the flavor of the month kind of thing that comes up. And it's the same. There's really parallels, absolutely.
And Barbara, as dramaturg, I'm just curious what you think is most important for us to know about Molière, his background, his time.
Oh, there are so many things to know about Molière. I think that one of the things that's important in his dramaturgy, the way he constructed his plays, is the influence of the Italian comic form Commedia dell'arte. That form used stock characters and rehearsed bits of business and was an improvised comedy. And a company of actors would play this improvised comedy. Molière worked with actors in that form for many years in his sort of apprenticeship, and his plays all adapt Commedia dell'arte characters into the plays that he wrote. So that form, I think, gives life and form to Molière's comedies.
And Charlie, as an actor, is this your first Molière?
This is, yes. It's not my first, this would fall under high comedy, it's not my first high comedy part. I've always played the mischievous servant, so I've finally been promoted up to to the foolish master.
And yeah. What's different about playing Molière?
Well, I would say the timing is so precise. It's like Tom Stoppard, and it's Tom Stoppard, but it's also Mel Brooks, where you have to be absurd, but you can't let absurdity rule. You have to be precise and be able to pull it off and still have the audience believe that you are a person.
Well, that opening that we started with about the price of the enema, Patricia, can you set up that scene and then we could hear a little bit more of it. What are we hearing when Argonne is talking about the price of enemas and so on?
Well, this comes from the very top of the show when Argonne is adding up his bills from his doctor and his apothecary. And he's also, there's a bit of the miser in there as well as the hypochondriac. So he's trying to be very shrewd economically.
And do we know why he's become a hypochondriac?
He just is.
Okay.
He just is. No, we don't know why.
Does he have any actual physical ailments that have contributed to his?
Not really.
Not really.
No,
just...
no. But part of it is fashion. I mean, it was very fashionable to have these medical treatments. So the more enemas, the more of bleeding, the more of these treatments that you had, the higher up in society you were. And Argonne is one of these nouveau riche characters. And Barbara can talk more about enemas and the king. The king
well,
had the most.
I don't know how far we
want to go with that.
Yes.
Louis XIV and his predecessor, Louis XIII, were both very much engaged in this kind of fashionable medicine. And it's actually old-fashioned medicine because the circulation of the blood had been discovered by William Harvey earlier in the century, and that was a sort of new way of beginning to understand the human body. The old way was this centuries-old process of bleeding and purging, and the old-fashioned way was embraced by King Louis XIII and Louis XIV. Louis XIII was said to have had 215 doses of purgatives, 212 enemas, and 47 bleedings in a single year.
We're talking, by the way, about, what, 1673?
Yeah.
Play,
yes, yeah.
And
uh-huh.
Give you
yeah.
some historical
right.
perspective
right.
on medical right. history.
And Louis XIV had 2,000 enemas in his lifetime, they estimate. Some of them while he was actually holding court.
It's kind of shocking that they
holding court.
It's kind of shocking that they kept track.
Well, so in a play like this, then, where there's obvious fun being made of the process, the practice, and the king is the leading practitioner, how does Molière avoid running afoul of the King of France in a play like this?
Well, in this case, it was not performed in its initial performance at court. Many of his plays were. This one was not. It was first performed before the paying public. He'd run into royal opposition earlier in his career with Tartuffe, which is a criticism of religious hypocrisy. And so he was unafraid to tackle issues that the king might disagree with him on.
And it does seem as if that's a theme running through a lot of his plays, isn't it? The way that our real selves are not what we like to pretend to be or how, you know, we have these images that we project, hypocrites all over the place.
Popular theme of the day. I mean, in England, too, at this time, Restoration drama, you have this dissembling and nobody is what he or she appears to be.
Exactly, exactly. And the what's beautiful about Commedia dell'arte is that there are stock characters that are recognizable in any time, any country, any year. We have the same thing. So these people are really recognizable. The lovers, the wily servant, the pompous master, the dottore, the professor who's full of himself and all of that. So
not
all
as
of these.
As he
exactly.
Pretends to be.
Exactly.
The gold digging stepmother.
Exactly. All of these. And part of, I think, the reason that this work has survived is that, well, Molière was an actor as well as a playwright, as Shakespeare was. And the Commedia tradition is still with us. I mean, it led to vaudeville. It led to what we see on Saturday Night Live and Mel Brooks. And these are Commedia characters.
And not subtle.
And not subtle.
And yet Molière has to do something to make them fully rounded characters or we're watching a puppet play.
Absolutely. Well, they are. I think there's a lot of opposites in these characters as well. This is the trick, what Charlie was talking about. The challenge of performing Molière is we have to get that balance of really telling the story and seeing the world through the lens, through the eyes of these particular characters and being true to that without judging it. We let the audience judge that. Mm-hmm. And
there's also the element of if you go too far away from the tradition, it's absurd. So if you start trying to play this as Tennessee Williams, then all of a sudden, not only is it not funny, but your attempt at truth starts feeling very false because that that's not how it's written, that's not how the rhythms are, and that's not how the characters are structured.
So what's the point of reference for a play like this? Do you always have to have a, quote, normal character in there as a foil to all the nuts?
Most of Molière's plays are constructed so that you have extremely foolish people in the lead role, the miser or the hypocrite or the misanthrope or the hypochondriac. Mm-hmm. And then that central character is surrounded by people who are either equally foolish or equally dishonest. I mean, they're out for themselves, mm-hmm. but they're all sort of exaggerations of what we think of as human nature. Then he usually includes at least one, sometimes two or three characters who are sensible and who look at these foolish people around them or these crafty people around them and say, "Don't you see?" And they look at the audience and they connect to the audience. They help the audience see the parameters of the foolishness or the knavery that the others are engaging in.
These stray characters are actually looking at the audience as these things go, which is also a tradition that has gone on, I mean, for a long time, even in The Office. You know, if you've ever seen that on TV, it's back with a vengeance in that format.
Sure. It's sharing with the audience. The audience is another character in the play.
Yeah, very effective.
Quite literally.
Yeah, and they're sort of presumed to be sensible. But, of course, we know better.
And I think it's also that there are the characters who can communicate to the audience, you know, with a wink, and they know what's going on. And then the foolish characters, like Argan is the foolish master, he still communicates with the audience. But he, in order for it to work, he has to believe everything he says and believe that the audience
is
on his side too.
Well, before we hear your opening, more of the monologue that we open the show with, can you tell us your view of Argan? Describe, you know, who you think you are when you're playing him.
Well, I immediately went to when I pretended to be sick when I was a little kid. And what I found out was when you went into the doctor's or into the nurse's office in elementary school, if you just put some water in your hands, threw it into the toilet bowl, and then flushed the toilet, the nurses thought you threw up and you just, you know, make yourself look like you cry. And what that meant was that I got to go because my mom worked for my grandpa. I got to go to Grandpa's office and, you know, have a happy meal and hang out with Grandpa for the whole afternoon. And so I really see Argan as he started out in that same way, getting attention for it. And then after a while, he started to believe his own lies. And, I mean, when you're taking how many enemas, there is an element of, with the makeup on stage that I'm going to have, you can see, the guy's been, what's the word?
Wrung out?
Emptied, drained a bit. and so he's still trying to get the attention, but he keeps having to top himself. And, well, that's not written in there. That's
and
how I see him.
Is he genuinely anxious? You know how people have medical anxiety where they think, you know, a mole is cancer and everything. Is he ridden with anxiety? Does he worry about himself?
Definitely. I think one of the most crucial parts of these Molière characters is with the fools is that if you're going to play a good fool, he believes it and the stakes are real for him. There are elements where he thinks he's so clever, but at the core, yeah, he completely believes it.
Well, let's hear what you have to say here.
In addition, on the 25th, a good, bracing purgative composed of lemon juice, maple syrup, cayenne pepper, and others followed as prescribed by Dr. Pagan to expel, evacuate the bile of the patient for a livre. Monsieur Florent, you mock me. My trying to stay alive is lining your pockets. Dr. Pagan did not order you to add 4 livres. Put down 3 livres, if you please. Plus, on the stated day, an alleviating and astringent potion in order to relax the patient, 30 sous. Additionally, on the 26th, 12 anti-flatulent tablets to chase away the foul winds from the patient's bowels, 30 sous.
A pleasant man.
Does anyone else believe him? take him at his word. I mean, the doctors clearly are just, there's a line in there somewhere about, well, they're having a heyday with his body, you know, for their profit. But is anybody who really buys it?
It's the emperor with no clothes. Uh-huh.
Yeah. His wife encourages him in his illness because she thinks she's going to make some money off him.
and later on, he finds a bill, and it says that he's being treated. I don't think he was supposed to see this bill, that he's being treated for hypochondria with enemas and bleedings. And of course, he goes, oh, he must have mixed up another patient's bill with mine. That can't be me.
Would Molière have read Ben Jonson's Volpone? You know, where someone pretends to be sick and then it becomes true and he actually gets ill? Because is there a sense in which there's almost a self-fulfilling prophecy that if you treat yourself, if you think you're ill and then get treated with all this horrible stuff, you are going to actually become ill?
I don't know the answer to that. I instinctively doubt it, but I don't know that for sure. I don't know that Molière spoke English. I don't know that Jonson was translated.
You said your makeup shows you as becoming drawn and emptied and so on. But do you make yourself sick through hypochondria?
Well, his brother, Berold, who is the voice of the contemporary circulationist theory, the contemporary take on medicine, there's a scene that's a debate between Argonne and his brother, Argonne being the traditionalist, Berold being the more contemporary viewpoint on it. And he has a statement that, you know, you're the healthiest man alive because you're still standing after all these treatments.
Despite all the medicine.
Right,
right.
Right.
And there's an anecdote about Louis XIV who took all of these, so many enemas during his life. An historian remarked that we begin to understand the justness of the cynic's remark that Louis XIV resisted the care of his physicians for over 77 years.
Go figure. Go figure. And there's a spin at the very end where Argonne wants to marry his daughter to a physician because then it's cheap medical care. And the brother's very clever, and he says, well, why don't you become a doctor yourself rather than have a son-in-law? And he said, well, I can't. I'm too old to study. And he said, no, no, no. Who knows more about medicine than you do because of your experience?
It's kind of the end of The Wizard of Oz where, you know, the wizard gives the scarecrow a brain. he gives him the diploma, and all of a sudden he knows everything.
Right.
At the end of the play, there's also this wonderful misuse of Latin, which would be the learned language of the physician. How do you convey that? We get some really interesting translation challenges, don't we, with
right,
this play?
I mean, huge.
17th century French, for one thing. I guess that's the least of them.
Mm-hmm.
But when you start talking about this mishmash of, what is it, Latin and Italian and other languages that are supposed to show erudition, but of course fall short. How do you do that?
Well, in Molière, there's a lot of court ballets. He was known that was something that he was known for in his plays that don't translate so well now. Lully and Charpentier, the musicians, worked with Molière.
Yeah, we heard Charpentier's overture to this play.
So it's always, every translation of this play that you see, the end is very different because it was a patois of French and Latin and, of course, in translation, English as well. So to make sense of all of this, Eric Callahan, PhD student who did the translation of this, I think did a really, really nice job in terms of breaking it down into sections. So there's the introduction of a general mask of patients and doctors. And then it goes into the examination of Argonne to be allowed into the ranks of the physicians. And then it goes into his taking of the oath. And then it's the celebration in terms of his being granted the position of being a physician. So having those categories helped a lot, but it's still very difficult to get this. And we do have a patois of the Latin and the English and the French. We also have physician masks. We're doing the last part in masks. And the costumes for this are drop-dead gorgeous, by the way. But anyway, the challenge also of speaking clearly while having this mask with a huge nose, proboscis in front, has been a challenge for everybody.
I was going to ask about the visuals in this play. I mean, it's obviously high, broad comedy. Mm-hmm. To what extent do you have to capture that with? And you mentioned, Charlie, the timing.
Mm-hmm.
How do you convey it visually?
Well, we're doing this production as all undergrads, by the way, a very talented group. Everyone is an undergrad. in the cast. And we didn't want to just do a historical production of Molière. But on the other hand, we didn't want to do something that was gimmicky and that wasn't true to Molière. So we bantered around lots of ideas, and it was our costume designer, Rachel Barnett, who brought in the idea of using steampunk aesthetic as a base for this production.
Which is?
I didn't know about it either, but it's a subculture that's actually growing. And it's, see if I can explain, the steam part of it relates to the steam engine. And so turn of the century, Victorian times, it's as though we have the technology that we have now, but it's put in Victorian aesthetic in terms of the lines and the materials and all of that. So it might be Jules Verne, for instance. It's futuristic, but it's relating to a previous time. So we thought, okay, rather than Victorian times, what about 17th century? Can we do kind of a contemporary spin, which is the steampunk, so the way people dress and materials
now,
are...
Why punk?
It's a subculture of like cyberpunk and gothic and that type of thing, except it's much more... I'm not very deep into this, but from what I understand and from what I've seen, it's much more of a positive spin rather than a dark, kind of depressing place to go with it.
I think the philosophy of steampunk, and I understand that it's a complicated and anxiety-ridden philosophy about the modern world, that's not something we really use because we don't think it's relevant to the world of Molière. What is absolutely fascinating is the visual aesthetic with a combination of elements from different periods making a kind of pastiche, which is not of any period. Mm-hmm. And so we find the servant character with a blouse made of Harlequin diamonds because she's sort of based on the Commedia dell'arte Harlequin character. But then she's got kind of a leather bustier and knee-high, high-heeled boots with her little skirt. And it's a lovely combination of both the old and the new in terms of the Molière characters. And so that's what Rachel Barnett, our costume designer, has been able to do for all of these characters. We see both the old and the new in Argonne, who is a pantalone figure with his red sort of undershirt and pointy beard and problems with his daughter. But then that's translated again into more contemporary dressing gown kind of dress.
Right. For instance, one of the characters has a wig that's basically a 17th century style, but it's also a punk wig that is very popular within the steampunk culture in terms of the style. Yeah, it's got the dreads in it and everything. And so that combination, it just gave a little spin to it, and yet it works beautifully.
Now, you do an interesting thing as a theater department, and maybe this is more even universal than that, but I know that in some cases when you're rehearsing before the dress rehearsal, the actors are instructed to put on parts of their costumes at least to get into the frame of mind. How would that work with this sort of costume?
You want to talk about it, Charlie?
There was a time, must have been a week and a half ago, where I was not playing Argonne. I was playing a smaller role before I got promoted.
Argonne got sick and you...
Yeah, right, and I had to jump in. And my costume consisted of a peg leg and a severed arm with a robotic hand and a eyepiece. So,
and he was playing one of the doctors.
Yep.
Oh, you're playing one of the doctors.
And my theory is he operated on himself.
Yeah, right,
but
right.
Basically, to put on the peg leg, I had to strap my foot up behind my back, suspended over my shoulders in about a dozen buckles, and then have my arm strapped to my side and have this elaborate magnifying glass eye patch. And all in all, it took about 30 minutes, I would say, to get me completely strapped into rehearsal gear. That's not even counting putting on makeup and costume, or the full costume. But the more elements you can have in rehearsal, the less like jumping into, you know, ice water it's going to be when you actually have those elements thrown at you. So the actors all of a sudden are familiar with things.
We're going to find out more about Molière in the 21st century when we continue in a moment with University of the Air.
WPR can be heard on your radio almost anywhere in the state, and you can listen online, too. You can find the programming schedule for your area at WPR.org. Click on Studios, Stations, and Program Schedules to find out more.
I'm Norman Gilliland, back with Emily Auerbach, and our guests, director Patricia Boyette, dramaturg Barbara Clayton, and actor Charlie Bauer, all of whom are involved in the University Theater's production of Molière's classic comedy, The Imaginary Invalid, which will be running at University Theater from October 22nd through November 7th, selected evenings and afternoons. And by the way, for more information about that, you can go to our website, that's WPR.org, and click on the University of the Air page, and you can link to all kinds of performance and background information about The Imaginary Invalid. We were on the topic just now of costumes, and that makes me wonder, Patricia, and actually everybody, how the costume affects not just your attitude toward the character, which we were talking about, but also just plain getting around on the set. I mean, if your leg is tied up over your shoulder, as you were saying, for example, how do you work with that?
Well, that's a unique situation.
But I mean, all of these costumes sound this steampunk.
Yeah, but Rachel Barnett, our costume designer, has done an incredible job of following the tradition of commedia, as well as we've been talking about, in terms of making each of the characters very distinct. So these costumes really are helping the characters very much. One of the things about commedia is it's based on animals. Pantalone, the old man, for instance, the chicken, is his kind of shamanistic animal. And those rhythms and that tempo is part of what goes into it. And so Rachel has looked at that with Pantalone and followed that. And it does make you think and feel and move a certain way.
Like a chicken.
Like a chicken. Florent, Florent, the apothecary. And the apothecary is the one who administers the enemas. Our apothecary, we used a peacock for his animal. And so the costume really absolutely helps him with that image.
All right. How about Argonne, though?
Well, Argonne's got the traditional pantalone. Instead of the red long johns and the robe that goes over that, he's got red pajamas.
Oh, suitable
and the
for
robe,
a hypochondriac.
And then a turban, this whole kind of Eastern exotic influence of the period.
It's the comfiest costumes.
That sounds better than the one you had.
Oh, yes.
And we've been very lucky to have a lot of the costume pieces to work with in the rehearsal room. Everybody's got the shoes and all of that. So actually, rather than being an obstacle, it's very much an aid.
And what about the set? When we come and the curtain opens, what are we going to see that will transport us to this, the world of Imaginary Invalid? Mm-hmm. How much of it is going to be a world familiar to us? How much something
A lot of trompe d'oeil. A lot of scenic painting. There's a perspective, and there's three flats. And the theater of the period had a lot of painting on flats, so we've taken that up. The setting of the play is in Molière's apartment in Paris. So the room, the doorway, it looks like a big room, but it's all painted. It's all fooling the eye with the perspective. And in the middle, I don't know how much I want to give away, actually, some of what goes on. But it's also very much following the commedia tradition in terms of we've got the movement in and out. It's a farce. Mm-hmm. So within these flat surfaces that are painted to look as though they're not flat, they're designed in a way that we have movement of Argonne's wheelchair in and out and the character's chase scenes, this type of thing. So in some ways, it's very, very simple. It's like the commedia stage. It didn't have really a lot on it. Mm-hmm. The steampunk part of it is having this flat surface and the trompe d'oeil effect, but also within that having some realistic elements.
We mentioned Charpentier, you mentioned Lully, two of the greatest French composers of all time, and I know this was also a tradition in England to have Henry Purcell provide music? I mean, he was the best composer of the era. Do you do anything with that music, or do you use that as a point of departure?
Well, actually, a point of departure is interesting because that's exactly what we did. We're beginning with a little Charpentier. But then the challenge that our sound designers had is how to blend the Charpentier with contemporary music. And there's a lot of contemporary music. We found that rock music, using harpsichord and using some of the traditional instruments of the time. So we've melded this together. And one of the beautiful things about Commedia, too, and I think the reason that this play is able to survive and be so flexible is that it's not pure.
It's a hodgepodge.
Molière was not. It is a hodgepodge. It's not pure. In Molière's day, it was not pure. He took whatever worked, regardless of the tradition and the location. And so we're doing the same thing.
Was there ballet in those days?
Oh, absolutely. That was part of the court mask.
I can't wait to hear what the
dancing
looks like.
Well, we have one character, Angélique, who's one of the lovers, in a costume that's taking – we used a lot of the ballet as an influence in her costume. And she has a lot of ballet in her character, her entrances.
I do notice that a lot of the description, the sort of press releases about the play, focus on the healthcare debate that's going on right now. Can you tell us something about what happens in the play in terms of the discussions of medical care?
I think that what it addresses is how difficult it is for old attitudes to give way to new information. And each proponent of each side holds on as if one's life depended on it. Of course, in some cases it does. And so it is in itself a debate, not about health care, but about approaches to medical care, but the fervency with which opinions are held and the fear that happens if they're not followed is certainly resonant in this play.
Can you give us a sample of the debate between the brother and Argonne that illustrates that?
We can. The brother wasn't able to be here today, so I'm going to read the brother's part. Hérold is the brother's name, and he's come primarily to dissuade Argonne from making a foolish marriage choice for his daughter, but then the argument broadens to other things. Brother, I want to talk to you, but first promise me that you won't lose control of yourself.
Promised.
You'll hear me out first before overreacting?
Yes.
And we can have a civilized conversation without you flying off the handle?
My God, yes. What a preface.
How is it, brother, that with all your wealth and only having one child, since I don't count the little one, how can you talk about putting her in a convent?
How is it, brother, that I am in charge of my family and I should do what I think is best?
Your wife certainly advises you to disinherit your daughter, though I'm sure it's simply out of a spirit of charity that she would be delighted to see her become a nun.
Oh, and here we go again, always on about my poor wife. It's always her fault. Everyone has it in for her.
No, Argonne, let's leave her out of it. She's a woman with only the best intentions in the world for your family, without any interest in personal gain, who treats you with remarkable tenderness and who demonstrates incomparable affection to your child, there's no doubt. Now, back to your daughter. What gave you the idea to marry her to a doctor?
The idea, brother, to choose a son-in-law that suits me.
That is irrelevant in this case, brother. There's a more suitable match for your daughter.
Yes, brother, but this one is more suitable for me.
But, brother, does she need to take a husband for her or for you?
For both, brother. And I would rather invite into my family the people that I need.
So using this logic, you try to marry the little one to a pharmacist when she grows up?
Why not?
Are you really so wrapped up in your pharmacists and your doctors and your insistence on being sick that you don't see what you are doing?
What are you talking about?
As I see it, brother, there has never been a less sick person than you. I could never ask for better health than yours. The proof lies in the fact that you're still standing. You have a perfectly healthy body after all the lengths you've taken to ruin it. And you haven't keeled over from all of the pointless medicines you've taken.
Can't you understand, brother? It's these medicines that keep me alive. Dr. Pagan says 3 days without them would do me in.
Be careful. He'll take such good care of you, he'll send you into the next world.
Be a little reasonable, brother. You don't believe in medicine at all?
Not at all, brother. I don't see any reason to believe in it.
What? You don't give any merit to a worldwide, centuries-long established and revered tradition?
Not only don't I see any merit, I find it's one of the biggest wastes of time permitted by mankind. There's nothing more ridiculous than believing one man can cure another. There are certain mysteries of our bodies we will never understand.
So in your opinion, doctors know nothing?
Brother, they have an extensive amount of classical learning. They speak beautiful Latin and know how to identify different illnesses. But in terms of curing them, they know almost nothing at all. Most of their work consists of pompous gibberish and unrecognizable jargon that gives words in place of reasons and promises in place of results.
Then why, brother, do people just as wise and clever as you turn to doctors when they're sick?
It's human weakness. Not evidence of doctor's skill.
So then what should we do when we're sick?
Nothing.
Nothing?
Nothing. We must all relax. Nature, when we let it, gently puts everything back in order. It's our own impatience and nervousness that ruins everything. Just as many people die from medical treatment as from the actual illness itself.
But don't you think that sometimes medicine assists nature?
I should bring you to see one of Molière's comedies.
That's a cheeky good-for-nothing, your Molière with his comedies, making fun of doctors.
He doesn't make fun of doctors, but the absurdity of their doctoring.
And what does he know of doctoring? He's a fine, insolent fellow to make fun of consultations and prescriptions, attacking doctors and satirizing on stage such respected and revered gentlemen. The devil with him! If I were one of his doctors, I would seek revenge the next time he fell ill by refusing to treat him and letting him die. He'll have nice things to say then. I wouldn't order him even the tiniest little bleeding or tiniest little enema. I would tell him, suffer! Suffer! That'll teach you to mock medicine.
And it's interesting, the line about, I would seek revenge the next time he fell ill by refusing to treat him and letting him die. There's an interesting story that you may know about Molière, who was sick unto death when he played this last role of his career. And he opened the performance, and on its fourth performance, which was about a week after it opened, he had a coughing spell and hemorrhage and managed to finish the performance, but he died later that night from tuberculosis.
Yes. You can't even imagine writing that as a script and having it be believable.
That's on top of the other things that are going on in this dialogue, one of which is you have two characters in this conversation about medicine. I venture to say neither one of whom we would agree with today. One saying, oh, yeah, you should do all this stuff, and the other saying, oh, no, don't do anything. Okay. And they're both off kilter by our current way of thinking about things.
But it certainly sounds relevant to today, and whether it's food and what to eat or just different things where people are so convinced that their way is the only way.
Right.
The other thing that is remarkable about this, maybe it was a convention or at least maybe other playwrights did it, but I can't think of an example offhand. How often do playwrights write themselves into their own comedies like that?
And to such a degree. I mean, this is so poignant. He had pneumonia. I mean, he was really critically ill when he was doing this. And so in the play, Argonne is in this chair with wheels on it most of the time. As a matter of fact, that same chair is a precious relic at the Comédie Française. And on his birthday every year, the entire company comes out after whatever performance they're doing to honor Molière, and the chair is there.
We're going to have some final thoughts on Molière's The Imaginary Invalid when we continue in a moment with the University of the Year.
When you call us, we'll listen. Wisconsin Public Radio's audience services team has knowledgeable and friendly people who are ready to help you. Call us at 800-747-7444 with your comments, questions, and suggestions.
I'm Emily Auerbach, back with Norman Gilliland. Our guests are three members from the University Theater's production of The Imaginary Invalid. We have with us Patricia Boyette, the director, Barbara Clayton, the dramaturg, and Charlie Bauer, who is playing Argon, the hypochondriac, who is the imaginary invalid. It's a show that opens October 23rd and runs through November 7th at the University Theater, and we have information about that on our University of the Air website. One of the interesting things in the plot of The Imaginary Invalid, it seems to me, is when Argon decides to play dead and to see how people respond.
We have the wily servant, Toinette, who is mischievous but very commonsensical and tries to set Argon straight. So to demonstrate that his wife is a gold digger, which everybody's telling him but he completely cannot see and completely denies, she comes up with a ruse of his playing dead and then see how Baleen, his wife, reacts to it. And then he does the same thing with the daughter. So that's the setup. And when he plays dead, of course, with the gold-digging wife, the truth comes out. And then with the daughter, her loyalty for her father comes out.
Argon, is it hard to play dead?
Oh, no. Besides being off stage, it's the easiest part of the show.
Well, let's hear a little bit of the wife that is the gold-digger.
Okay. Hello, my darling.
Oh, my dear wife, come to me.
What's wrong, my poor husband?
Come here and help me.
What's the matter, my little man?
My snookerdoodle.
My honey pie.
They've gone and put me in a rage.
Oh, my poor little husband. What happened, dear?
Your ingrate of a Toinette has become more insolent than ever.
Don't upset yourself again.
She made me so angry, snookerdoodle.
Calmly, little man.
For the past hour, she has thwarted everything I have said and done.
There, calm down.
And had the audacity to tell me that I'm not really sick.
She is an impudent imp.
See, you know, my love, that's what she is.
Yes, my love, she's out of line.
My love, that pygmy devil woman is going to kill me.
Ah, there.
She's given me the diarrhea.
Oh. You mustn't get any angrier.
And I don't know how many times I have told you to fire her.
Good God, my little man, there's no such thing as a servant without faults. We must suffer through their bad qualities to profit from their good ones. This one is handy, careful, diligent, and above all, faithful. And you know nowadays you have to be very careful who you hire. Toinette!
Well, so that's the show she puts on for her husband.
Right.
But what about the real?
The real what? Toinette. You want a little of that?
The real Baleen,
rather.
Ah, my God, oh, the tragedy. What a frightful accident.
What is it, Toinette?
Oh, madame.
What's the matter?
Your husband is dead.
My husband is dead?
Alas, yes, the poor deceased is dead.
You're certain?
I'm certain. Nobody else knows yet. I was here by myself. He just passed away in my arms. Look, there he is, stretched out. In his chair.
Heaven be praised! Good riddance! How silly you are, Toinette, for mourning his death.
Well, I thought it would be appropriate to cry, madame.
Oh, go on. It's not worth the trouble. What loss is there? What good was he for anything? An inconvenience to everyone. Dirty, disgusting, never without an enema or medicine in his stomach. Sneezing, coughing, spitting all the time. Boring, with a bad temper, always tiring others, and yelling after servants night and day.
What a beautiful funeral oration.
You must assist me in executing my plan, Toinette. And you better believe that as a servant of mine, you'll be well compensated. Since by stroke of luck, no one else knows what has happened, let's carry him into his bed and hide the dead body just until I have my affairs in order. There's the will and some money I want to seize. It wouldn't be right to have passed the best years of my life with him without profiting. Come on, Toinette. Let's take his keys first.
Gently. Yes, my dear wife. So that's how you love me.
Aha! So the deceased isn't dead.
I'm comforted to see your true loving nature and to have heard that beautiful eulogy you gave me.
Wonderful, wonderful dramatic irony, I guess you'd call it there, where everybody except one character knows what's going on.
Right.
In this case, it's the wife.
Right. And another example of Molière showing people the way they really are rather than
exactly.
how they pretend to be.
Exactly.
Is illness a metaphor in this play for other things? Is the hypochondria, could you see it as representing other ways that we behave?
Well, there's physical illness, and then there's the mental construct of what's going on in people's minds. There's the extreme of being so caught up on with whatever is fashionable or whatever is the flavor of the month kind of situation that the commonsensical characters who are on the side of the audience, who see things as the audience, Toinette and Barrault to a certain extent. But Toinette is the one who really is kind of representative of the audience, seeing the common sense. But everybody else is out in some kind of limb. And I think that we do go out on limbs. So it's not just physical illness that's being discussed here. It's
yeah.
also, you know. Mm-hmm.
And I also think they're selfish characters.
Mm-hmm.
And I
yeah.
think that's one of the main
yeah.
things,
greed.
Whether it's
do
our God.
Do you think
God.
The wife is selfish?
Yeah. Oh, I don't know.
Well, the egotism of an invalid who wants all the attention.
Right. And mm-hmm. everybody's mm-hmm. thinking about right. the world and other people in terms of how it will benefit them.
Mm-hmm.
And the sensible people tend to have a broader view than that.
This was Molière's last play, obviously.
Yeah.
I mean, as we said, he died during the fourth performance of it. What was his status in France at the time of his death, or the status of any great actor, playwright?
He was a favorite of Louis XIV and played more commonly at the Royal Palace than he did in the Palais Royal, the public theater at the time. Yet, as an actor, he was excommunicated from his church when he died, was denied last rites by his priest, and it was only through the intercession of his wife, who appealed to the king, that he was allowed to be buried in the church grounds of the church right near his house. He wasn't buried in the regular churchyard, but rather in a part of the cemetery set aside for unchristened infants. And this was all done in the dead of night so that no one could see his burial. So there was no Victor Hugo-like parade down the streets of Paris for Molière. He was then reburied later on in a more significant place and with a tombstone. But the actor was in England, in France, and in other European countries, a persona non grata, a vagabond, a person without a permanent residence and a permanent stake in a community.
Low moral values.
And it was worse for actresses.
Yes.
yes, indeed.
The equivalent of being a prostitute.
I also think it's interesting for me as an actor, too, because I mean, I have no idea if this is true or not, but in the first two of the three acts, Argonne has so many lines. And then all of a sudden in the third act, he just doesn't have as many. And I have no idea if this is true, but my theory is that he started getting sick right when he was writing that third act and wanted to be able to get off stage as soon as possible, so he stopped giving himself such big speeches.
Interesting theory.
Either that or Argonne starting to listen to others.
Yeah, that doesn't happen until...
That doesn't happen.
That happens.
That never happens.
There's an ironic moment in the text. Toinette, who is playing a fake doctor, is coming in to diagnose Argonne, and she takes his pulse and she does other things and asks him to recount his symptoms. And he talks about, you know, his head hurts and his cough. And every time he says something, she says, "It's the lungs. It's the lungs. It's the lungs. It's the lungs."
And
what's interesting is that Molière, when he was playing that role, it was the lungs.
So he had some inside jokes there.
Almost literally
gallows humor.
So if I bring my husband, who's a lung doctor, if I bring him to this production of yours, of The Imaginary Invalid, will he come out of there feeling doctors have been attacked? And in a fair way?
Oh, I don't think so. I don't think so at all. It's more about extremism.
Is it about quacks? Is it about
profit-making?
It's about ambulance chasers.
Absolutely.
Well, and it's about how difficult it is to be certain about medical knowledge, because medical knowledge is always growing. And as theories change, practice follows behind. And this is at a time when this was written at a time when theories were changing, but the practice was still rattling on behind.
And I think that's still around, too, when you watch a big show like House, where you'll have on that show a patient will go to doctor after doctor after doctor, and nobody can cure them. And they have to eventually go to a one in a million genius to get cured.
But it still takes six different diagnoses right. to get through half
and
an hour.
And usually breaking
plot.
The law and some other things.
20 minutes of commercials. So.
Influence of Molière on playwrights to follow? I mean, you mentioned Saturday Night Live
right.
as a distant
well,
descendant.
I think, from 300 years ago and up, you know, every century, I think, has had someone who has taken off from the foundation laid by Molière. And he took off from the foundations, of course, laid before his time. But farce, any kind of clowning, any kind of farce, and you can find elements of that in Molière.
And you had mentioned how Molière references himself and how it's hard to think of someone else who does that. And then you think of Robin Hood Men in Tights, classic Mel Brooks. And when I think the first line in that movie is all the peasants yelling, "Leave us alone, Mel Brooks." So, yeah, that influence, whether it's real or not, is still there.
I mean, Molière, that line in there that Argonne says about Molière to his brother, when his brother says, "I should take you to see Molière if you want to answer that question." And that in-joke kind of thing.
Yeah, right, the in-joke. Very
much Huckleberry Finn talking about Mark Twain. So
that convention.
Probably a lot of successors to Molière.
The comedies of the late 17th century in France through the 18th and into the 19th, there are many, many direct translations of Molière's comedies onto the English stage, usually adapted for English taste, but there wasn't any international copyright law that protected these texts. And so there was lots of trade back and forth and alt-right thievery of plot lines and characters. Mm-hmm.
That could have been another thing Molière would have had fun with had he lived long enough, satirizing literary pirates. That is also still very much with us, too.
Well, we want to thank our guests, Patricia Boyette, Barbara Clayton, and Charlie Bauer, for joining us for this episode of University of the Air, and best of luck to you with the production.
Well, thank you.
Thank you very much.
I'm Emily Auerbach with Norman Gilliland, hoping you'll join us for the next hour of University of the Air.